Today on Straight Talk Africa, we bring you a special edition. It's a broadcast of a Voice of America produced documentary on Boko Haram, A Journey from Evil. That's coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America studios here in Washington. I am Shaka Sali. A Journey from Evil, VOA's special documentary about the Boko Haram terror group. This VOA film premiered in London on November 8th. Now it's your turn to preview. So stay tuned for Boko Haram, A Journey from Evil.
Someday, tranquility will settle upon Borno State in northeast Nigeria. The ordinary rhythms of life in the rural areas will return, as will the everyday bustle of the city. But for now, a restless tension lurks beneath the surface. Not a moment goes by without the threat of violence. Without the fear that the militant Islamic group Boko Haram might unleash an attack. A grim reminder of a conflict still to be resolved. A country's struggle with extremism. An unfinished journey from evil. Yet there are Nigerians who've stood up to the terror, who've shown the courage to fight back, the determination to go forward, and the resilience to forge a new future for their nation. Each morning in the town of Chibok, Rebecca Solomon goes about her chores. But what may appear a simple life became for her a nightmare that began on April 14th, 2014. That evening, Rebecca's daughter, Deborah, was staying overnight in a government school dormitory preparing to take exams the next day. The exams never took place. Deborah is one of the kidnapped Chibok girls believed to be held in a remote forest hideout. It's been 1,000 days since Rebecca has seen her daughter. Deborah's abduction, along with over 200 other girls, exposed to the world Boko Haram's ruthlessness, as well as the dysfunction of Nigeria's government and military. And it stirred many Nigerians to take action on their own. Buki Shonibare had planned a career as a human resources consultant in Abuja, Nigeria's capital.
But then 2014, April 14 happened, and that just opened me up to another life entirely.
Buki became a frontline campaigner for the Bring Back Our Girls movement.
Last night I could not sleep, and for once I felt what it meant for those girls to be out there. And then we came out to stand in solidarity with these girls, and then we are being blocked off. Nothing will stop us. Yeah. We will keep coming out until our girls return.
What do we want?
Action! Aided by social media, the Bring Back Our Girls campaign sparked worldwide condemnation of Boko Haram.
Our girls!
Bring back our girls!
Our girls!
Bring back our
Like millions of people across the globe, my husband and I are outraged and heartbroken over the kidnapping of more than 200 Nigerian girls from their school dormitory in the middle of the night.
Boko Haram's leader, Abubakar Shekau, capitalized on the group's sudden notoriety, threatening to convert the girls to Islam, marry them off to his commanders, or sell them into slavery. For Buki, it was personal.
It's simply because I was once that girl, even though I've not been abducted before, but I know what it means to be sexually molested. I know what it means to have to do something because you want to stay alive.
With the international community watching, the Nigerian government issued promises to save the girls. But the lack of swift action angered parents.
If the government cannot take action, we are asking for the United Nations to come in and help us. Or if the United Nations reject us, we just don't know what to do.
Within 2 weeks of the Chibok kidnappings, Buki had made up her mind to stay on the front lines and keep protesting until the girls came home.
And we were screaming like 15 whole days. Some parents have not seen their children. 15 whole days. Where are they? And then we had to commemorate 30 days. And we could not live with that reality.
In truth, the reality was worse. Buki had no idea at the time, but the 30 days would eventually stretch into more than 3 years. Nigeria. Rich in oil and natural gas. A nation seeking to present itself as the image of modern Africa. But a country that is far from united.
180 million people plus, 250 ethnic groups, thereabouts. This is a difficult country to govern at the best of times.
Splitting the north from the oil-rich south are cultural and economic fault lines that date far back to Nigeria's colonial past. In the predominantly rural and traditionally Muslim northeast, that fault line is fragile. Although Nigeria collects billions of dollars selling its oil each year, more than 60% of Nigerians live in poverty, many on less than $2 a day. In the northeast, the poverty rate is even higher.
We're speaking about northeastern Nigeria that is really one of the most impoverished and marginalized regions of the country. This is a region that had one of the lowest literacy rates in the country, one of the highest infant mortality rates in Nigeria. So things, the nature of governance was really poor to begin with, and people were frustrated and seeing the growing levels of inequality in this community.
Poverty and inequality, along with neglect by those with political power, helped sow a rebellious brand of Islam in the northeast. Its leaders took as their model one of the world's most brutal and dogmatic Islamist movements.
It was at that time in 2003 that there was a community of individuals that moved to the borderlands of Nigeria and Niger in an attempt to create a purist Islamic society based on the model of the Taliban in Afghanistan.
Originally, the group was peaceful and its message inclusive.
What they preached was, we have an alternative system. If the system you believe in does not value you and leaves you out, we will not do that. We are more inclusive. We will take care of you. We are doing Allah's will, and we will define our own society, an alternative society that is just and good. So that was very appealing, especially for people who felt left out.
But eventually, this alternative society split. The leader of its dominant faction wanted a pure form of Islam and an outright insurrection against the government. His name, Muhammad Yusuf. Yusuf was intelligent and charismatic, but bent on confrontation. People began calling his movement Boko Haram. Literally, Western education is forbidden. Although the group disavowed the name and still does, it captured Yusuf's essential beliefs. He preached that Western values were undermining Islam, and he called for a holy war.
It's difficult for the West to understand jihad, in part because our modern societies are, by their very nature, essentially secular. We've come to terms that religion is not a reasonable pathway to organize modern society. Whereas those who are pushing for jihad are saying that religion is the correct way to shape a righteous Muslim society, a land of faithful Muslims. So invariably, those two positions are going to be extremely difficult to reconcile.
Yusuf's base was the northeastern city of Maiduguri, the capital of Borno State. As his sermons became more militant, tensions with local authorities grew. Then, in 2009, Boko Haram exploded into Nigeria's wider consciousness. That June, police clashed with some of Yusuf's followers on their way to a funeral, wounding more than a dozen. Yusuf denounced the government actions, and a few weeks later, his followers struck back. With guns and grenades, they attacked police stations in several cities, with the heaviest assault in Maiduguri. Over 4 days of fighting, the police response was merciless. They rounded up Boko Haram suspects, killing them in the street. They destroyed Yusuf's mosque. Then they captured him and took him for interrogation. Hours later, his body was in the street. He'd been shot multiple times.
And he became a martyrdom figure to Boko Haram. And since 2009 until today, all factions of Boko Haram consider him their inspiration.
More than 1,000 people died in 4 days of fighting that July. Afterward, Boko Haram disappeared. But when they returned a year later, it was with more weapons and a new leader. A bombastic and violent Yusuf deputy, Abubakar Shekau. He proclaimed all-out war.
Their argument is a very simple one. You've come up after us. You've killed many of us. You've killed us literally by the thousands. You feel you've decimated our community. We will fight back. Now we will take jihad to you.
Over the next 4 years, Boko Haram put the Nigerian military and civilian security forces on their heels.
Within that period, the militancy and the insurgency of Boko Haram grew stronger and stronger, and it's in this context that Boko Haram was able to acquire land, acquire territory, with limited Nigerian response.
Boko Haram expanded its domain, but Maiduguri remained ground zero. The city of more than 500,000 had a teaching hospital and a university.
Before the insurgency, Maiduguri was a very quiet, peaceful town.
Fati Abubakar was a nursing student living with her family in Maiduguri at the time Boko Haram began its assault in 2010.
We were known for being very traditional, conservative people, and we all knew our neighbors. It was a very diverse community before Boko Haram.
Within months, Fati became a witness to the wholesale destruction of her hometown.
I watched everything happen, from the tension, the bomb blast, the dead bodies on the streets, you know, the houses burning. Sometimes our house would shake because of a bomb blast.
People soon fled. Fati and her family left in late 2012.
At the time, they were killing boys and kidnapping girls, so my parents were not comfortable with that. And then we moved to Abuja, and I lived there for 6 months before I went to London to study.
Fati completed her studies in London, writing a dissertation about the effects of war on the psychological health of refugees. And she found an outlet to help her cope with a loss she felt as a refugee herself.
really took up photography around that time that I was struggling with all that was happening around Maiduguri. And I was really interested in how you can do visual storytelling and still have an impact on the community.
Fatty returned to Maiduguri in 2015.
But when I came back, people had become desensitized. You know, it was like a transformation. They didn't even feel any of it. They just kept going. So that was what, you know, had my attention.
Fatty imagined another side of the place she called home, a humane side she wanted to show the world. It was the opposite of the images of war and destruction flooding the global news, and from the deluded propaganda of Boko Haram. In its videos, Boko Haram's leader, Shekau, glorified the group's violence in the name of Islam. But hidden inside his secretive caliphate, the reality was starkly different. Boko Haram brutalized fellow Muslims, beating and killing them at will to maintain control and religious piety. Graphic evidence of the group's conduct surfaced in 2016 when Voice of America journalists obtained and authenticated some 18 hours of videos shot by Boko Haram's own photographers. The raw footage is an unflinching record exposing how one of the world's deadliest extremist movements operates behind the scenes. A daily diary of terror. At public tribunals designed to enforce authority by intimidation and fear, villagers were herded together for displays of discipline. For small sins, offenders were flogged, sometimes by their peers. But for offenses like selling drugs, the punishment was ultimate. No pleading for the accused. Just a bullet in the heart or the head.
When Boko Haram first became violent, the attacks were mostly on the Nigerian state itself. So government offices, prisons, police headquarters. As time went on, and it seems that Boko Haram felt more and more aggrieved, its targets widened and widened. Until now, it seems to be anybody.
In their encampments, Boko Haram soldiers, many mere boys, trained for warfare and played like children.
The media characterizes Boko Haram as madmen, as crazy, as psychopaths. But what we can see in the footage of the foot soldiers is that in many respects, they go around their daily business just like kids in any other part of the world. We also see them receiving pep talks before battle, where they're told some of you are going to die and some soldiers are going to die. The difference is the soldiers aren't going to go to paradise and you are. And this goes to show that ideology plays a very important part of motivating them to engage in acts of killing. And after a period of time, these young boys become regular Boko Haram fighters willing to sacrifice their lives for the broader mission of the commanders to establish some form of Islamic governance.
It's impossible to know how many Nigerian boys have been conscripted into Boko Haram. Likely, it's several thousand. The penalty for refusal is severe. Danladi was abducted when he was 12, but found a way out later. Shown the Boko Haram video footage, he recognized some commanders and recounted how boys were forced to fight.
Aka da sun surata mu suka ce mu fara mu kwashi Ndugogio.
Shekau made clear that Boko Haram would cleanse Nigeria of anyone who didn't submit to its brand of Islam. Men or women, young or old, Christian or Muslim.
The Shekau faction of Boko Haram has a belief system whereby any Muslim that does not join their group is an apostate because they are fighting a legitimate jihad. And therefore, the idea that a Muslim would get killed in a Boko Haram attack, either because they're targeted or because it's collateral damage, is really not something that the Shekau faction worries about. Because their penalty for not joining the group and being apostates is death anyway.
2015 marked a shift in the war. The Nigerian army, aided by military from neighboring Chad, Cameroon, and Niger, began reclaiming towns and territories once under Boko Haram's control. The momentum quickened under a new president, Muhammadu Buhari, elected that year. But the government's success also brought disturbing allegations of human rights abuses, excesses by the military and civilian vigilantes in their zeal to defeat Boko Haram. Amnesty International cited thousands of summary executions, arbitrary arrests, and instances of torture by Nigerian forces. War crimes, the group said, went unpunished.
The Nigerian government somehow have some doubts in what Amnesty is doing. But all the same, they have come clean and set up a presidential task force. And you have to take into account the composition of members of the panel. They are not people that could be manipulated. They can be manipulated. And they are judges of repute. And we wait and see the results.
As the government ramped up its pursuit of Boko Haram, Abubakar Shekau changed his strategy too. Boko Haram officially aligned with the Islamic State, or ISIS, the jihadi group waging war in Iraq and Syria.
Shekau, in 2015, formally pledged allegiance to ISIS, and ISIS responded to this. Some see this as because this coincided with the time when Boko Haram was coming under increasing pressure from the Nigerian military. It was being pushed back. After this, you had the Pledge of Allegiance to ISIS. So it's read as actually this is something of a desperate move on the part of Boko Haram.
Boko Haram could claim affiliation with the largest jihadi group in the world. It began using Islamic State templates in its social media postings. But it was an insurgency on the run. At least three times, the Nigerian military claimed Shekau had been killed. Yet each time, he survived, reappearing like a ghost in new videos, recorded in a remote hideout, somewhere deep in the northeast bush. The Sambisa Forest. A thick jumble of thorny scrub and scattered trees spread across five northern states. A portion was set aside as a game reserve, but its once abundant wildlife has been depleted by war. Now parts of the Sambisa are Boko Haram's sanctuary, a vast area of danger for anyone who dares enter. In a village nearby, Aisha Bakari Gombe lives with her family. In her part-time job as a seamstress, she works with hands and feet in creative concentration, at peace, away from the violence that prowls in the countryside. But the rhythm of the sewing machine is only one facet of her world. Aisha knows the Sambisa well. It was there, as a young girl, that she was initiated in a long-standing family tradition. Boko Haram raided her village 3 times before the Nigerian government allowed people to fight back on their own. Now, instead of hunting antelope, baboons, and birds, Aisha goes after a different prey, Boko Haram militants. She is part of a group of hunters who go out in search of insurgents, ready to fight if the situation arises.
Ya kama shi ya yanka shi da zarton da ake yanka katako. Boko Haram zai kama mace da ciki, ya yanka ta, ya fidda da a cikin cikinta, ya jefar da shi. Boko Haram zai kama yaro jinjiri, ya karya wuyansa ya jefar. Ya kama yara ƙanana ya murɗa wuya ya jefa a kogi.
At the start of their patrol, the hunters take part in spiritual rituals. They believe it will protect against enemy bullets and other dangers in the forest.
Akwai abubuwa irin namu na gargajiya wanda muke amfani da su. Wani muna amfani da shi din mu sha, wani mu shafa, wani mu sheka, wani mu yi hayaki, har ma wanka akwai. To mu kan yi su ne kafin mu fita.
Ai dajin dama shi muka riga muka saba. Babu wani abun da yake ba mu tsoro a cikin daji. Duk lokacin da muka shirya in za mu fita, ko dare ko rana ne shiganta muke yi babu farka ba.
Aisha and her team not only search for insurgents, they're also on the lookout for captives fleeing from Boko Haram camps. Their stories can be heartbreaking.
Akwai matar da muka bari yanzu haka tana kam namu mu a inda muke muka yi sansani mu a cikin garin Lasa. Suka zo sace ta, suka sace ta da yara 6. Da aka tafi da su, aka je aka ajiye su a can sun kai watanni suna wajen. Ranar da Allah ya taimake ta ya bata nasaran za ta gudu ta dawo. To su waɗannan ƴan ƙanana guda 2, ɗaya ta goya, ɗaya kuma ta ɗauka ta rataya a kafadanta. Haka ta haƙura da wa'yancan saura guda 4 ta ɗauko 2 ta kamo hanya ta dawo.
Aisha's efforts fighting Boko Haram earned her the respect of fellow villagers. They call her the Queen Hunter.
Gaskiya ba zan iya sani ba, don an kutar da yawa. Na kwanakin nan ko kuma in ce na shekaran jiya mun kutar da tara.
Later that day, Aisha and her band apprehended 3 Boko Haram fighters. They delivered them to authorities by truck, a commotion of curious villagers parading behind them. Success like this inspires her to continue the work, despite the danger.
Ani dai ina son duniya ta sani. Aikin da muke yi dai mu aiki ne na ceto da nema wa ƙasar mu zaman lafiya. Zaman lafiya nake son wa Najeriya. Ina so in ga Najeriya ta zauna lafiya kamar yadda sauran ƙasashe suke zaune lafiya.
They appear in seemingly endless streams, fleeing terror, bringing with them only what they can carry. Day and night, they've lost their homes, their farms, their livestock, in the worst cases, their children. And for now, they've no hope of returning. The world knows Boko Haram mostly through reports of bombings, kidnappings, and suicide attacks. But the insurgency has also made millions of Nigerians homeless and laid waste to the rural economy that long sustained the region. In village after village, devastation.
The Boko Haram, they are rushing to this place. So that is their market.
1,000 houses gone.
Already destroyed.
Already destroyed. Our market is distressed. We will not get market. We will not get eat food.
Hamam Mbombo has survived two Boko Haram attacks. The first time, they took his crops. The second time, they burned his farm to the ground. Farmers are not the only ones suffering from Boko Haram's plundering. These herders narrowly escaped a Boko Haram surprise attack with their cattle. They're aware that next time they may not be so lucky.
What's caused this crisis is people being terrorized and having to run away from the place they've been able to work for a long time. We were told that farmers do have seeds. We were told that farmers do still have some of the tools. What they don't have is the confidence to go back to their land because they're worried that if they're a man, they'll be shot. They're worried that if they're a woman, they'll be raped or kidnapped. So the key issue here is security.
Although the Nigerian military has recaptured and garrisoned some larger towns, the Northeast's breadbasket remains a free fire zone. Much of the food production infrastructure, granaries, markets, wells, is in ruins. Rebuilding it will take months, if not years. Northeast Nigeria borders Lake Chad, a vast inland sea supplying fresh water to about 70 million people in four countries. Fishing forms an integral part of household economies in the region. But since the insurgency, Boko Haram has controlled fishing by demanding a tax from those plying their trade. As a result, many fishermen have fled, choking off the once thriving industry. Most are reluctant to talk openly about the insurgents, fearing reprisals.
A shakka babu ɗan Boko Haram sun kasara wannan sana'ar tamu gabaki ɗayanta. Domin ka kula duk tafkin cadin nan gabaki ɗaya duk wani mu'amala da ake yi wato biyo bayan kifi ne. Watanni hudu na shekara wanda an fi kama kifi a cikin su irin watannin zafi. To a lokacin ana iya fitar da trailer 70, 50, 60 a rana ɗaya. To amma kaga yanzu ko ɗaya ba a fitar ba.
Deprived of their livelihoods, farmers, herders, and fishermen, along with their families, wind up in the camps for the displaced that have sprung up across the Northeast. Official estimates put the number forced to leave their homes at 2 million or more. For years, the lack of security kept many humanitarian agencies from entering the region. Now that more military are present, they are returning to learn that the crisis is much worse than they predicted.
I think a lot of humanitarian aid workers are saying that they didn't realize the situation was that bad. Some have described it as famine-like conditions. Unfortunately, if it was addressed sooner, it wouldn't have gotten to the extent that it is now.
According to the United Nations, more than $1 billion in humanitarian aid was needed to help 8.5 million people in the Northeast and Lake Chad region in 2017. Most of it for food.
Children are particularly vulnerable because their bodies are growing, their minds are growing and developing, and if they don't have the nutrition that they need in the first 2 years of life, that has lifelong consequences for them. So a child, you know, who's 1 year old, who doesn't get enough to eat, will see her growth is stunted. She will have possibly trouble in, you know, cognitive development of her brain. You know, that'll affect her performance in school later on. It'll affect her ability to earn a living later on. So she will be paying the price for our failure for the rest of her life if we can't get that food and nutritional support to her now.
Without continued aid or a rebound in agriculture, Nigerians may be on the edge of famine for years to come. The emotional and psychological damage of the war has deep consequences and may pose the most difficult challenge of Nigeria's recovery.
Ba mu da sani a lokaci daya bokwaran suka shiga cikin garin mu suka fara kashe kashe ba mu da labarin komai ranan asabar misalin karfe 9
kani mama na guda 3 kani ka mijin kani na guda 1 guda 4 atake sun kashe
to da muna zama a wurin sun kawo wani mutum sun yanka shi a idon mu.
After 8 years of war, these stories have become all too common.
When we're coming out of insurgency, it's one thing to rebuild homes and to rebuild hospitals and to rebuild schools. But the most important thing is to rebuild people.
Dr. Fatima Akilu leads the NEEM Foundation, a non-profit that is taking on the country's psychological reconstruction. The work focuses on Nigerians who are homeless, suffered violence and trauma, or who were captives under Boko Haram. By sharing their stories, they help heal one another.
Our main objective is to hear their experience. We want to share our experience together so that we can see how we can support ourselves.
What we're looking at is their mental health status, their post-traumatic stress disorder needs, depression, anxiety, insomnia, psychosomatic symptoms.
These group sessions run for a month to build trust. Counselors help with translation.
They left. Anytime she remembers her son, she can't sleep because she didn't even see the body of her son.
One woman told of losing multiple family members.
When there was one attack in Maiduguri here, a suicide bomber came to where they were staying, and that was how her husband was killed.
That
she has a younger brother too.
Tamujin
Boko Haram killed him.
Amma yanzu dai alhamdulillah tunda nazo nan dai ana ba mu shawaran nan. Nagode wa Allah.
That she's really feeling better ever since she started coming to this place. And she's very grateful.
The counselors use cognitive therapy to help victims control traumatic flashbacks.
We focus on trying to get them to alter their negative thinking about the event that has happened. We try to teach them thought-stopping behaviors, and we try to teach them resilience through group.
2 months after their initial therapy, members of the group reconvene to see whether they're continuing to cope.
That in this gathering, if you come to this gathering, after hearing everybody's experience, you realize that your own problem, somebody has a bigger problem than your own.
Dr. Akilu says victims can cure these deep emotional wounds. It just takes time.
As a psychologist, I have a role that I can play. And I can bring people together to show that there is an alternative way.
Rebuilding the lives of Boko Haram's victims is only part of the healing process. Another challenge is finding alternatives for those who perpetrated the violence. These men are Boko Haram fighters who have recently surrendered. They're about to enter Operation Safe Corridor, where insurgents who've renounced Boko Haram can undergo rehabilitation while in prison.
It's a federal government initiative aimed at de-radicalizing, rehabilitating, and reintegrating willing and surrendered Boko Haram back into the society.
The men will undergo 3 months of counseling to dispel their indoctrination under Boko Haram. Dr. Akilu helped start an earlier de-radicalization effort in Nigeria. All these programs work on multiple levels.
One would be ideology, because that was what they used to recruit. Second was to look at their mental states, so we had psychological engagement. That we felt art was important because they were so against art, and art allows somebody to express themselves in ways unexpected to that person. And we taught them a skill, a trade, different for different people, and we also gave them an education for those who wanted it.
Under de-radicalization, the Boko Haram militants are classified as repentant fighters. VOA was allowed to visit one class, but authorities refused to allow cameras inside to protect ex-fighters from being identified.
So we are hoping that when you leave here, which we hope will be very soon, you will all go back and... You all go back and all the skills that is being impacted now, you will use them to the benefit of your families and to the benefit of Nigeria.
In terms of our de-radicalization, the positive there for us is there are more and more of the ex-combatants actually disengaging. Disengagement is key. Inshallah.
So I admonish all of you to take this program very, very seriously.
There is a debate about whether de-radicalization works or is appropriate. Among those who took part in Dr. Akilu's initial program was an imam who joined Boko Haram in its early stages, then preached against Western education. Caught by Nigerian forces, he was sent to prison with other fighters. That was before Dr. Akilu brought in Quranic scholars who persuaded him that Boko Haram manipulated key texts in the Holy Book to suit their agenda.
When we started working with Boko Haram members, I think for me the biggest surprise was how little knowledge they had of the Quran itself. And even including the chief imam, they had memorized parts of the Quran, but without context.
But whether such success can be repeated on the scale that's needed is unclear.
The problem is, if it doesn't work, then what? We must have something on the table that works. At the moment, it is de-radicalization. Look, the reality is that these people, they are Nigerians. And the fundamental question we should ask, to what extent did the Nigerian society contribute for them to become what they have become? And what should the Nigerian society do to get them back to living normal lives?
The conflict with Boko Haram casts northeastern Nigeria as a dark, dangerous place overcome with suffering and need. Months after returning home to Maiduguri in Borno State, Fathi Abubakar set about to change that image, armed with her camera.
We're usually bombarded with images of, you know, people, dead bodies on the street, you know, sites of bomb blasts, some children in the hospital. It's just a complete, you know, portrayal where you just think that there are no survivors of this conflict. There are different kind of stories that I felt that were completely neglected, and I wanted people to see that, yes, Borno State is struggling, but there are still people living there and they're continuing their lives.
Fatty posts her photography on Bits of Borno, a website she's created. For many, it's become a source of inspiration and renewal. She has over 7,000 followers on her Facebook page, 9,000 on Instagram. What they see is another side of Borno State, a proud region showcasing the rich diversity of Nigeria's people.
I have to be highly inclusive in this visual storytelling, so I try as much as possible to document all of the tribes in the community, ensure that it represents the whole of Borno State. And the Shuwa tribe are a very beautiful, very colorful tribe. The portraits I do, I feel are, you know, quintessential people of Borno State. And then I ask them questions about how life is. And then when I do a lot of the interviews, I transcribe and then I post the images on social media together with the narratives.
In her regular job, Fati works as a communications officer for UNICEF. Immersed in the Northeast's humanitarian crisis, she searches for moments of compassion and caring.
So I do a lot of human interest stories and photo essays, and I document all of UNICEF's activities so that we can post on social media. UNICEF has come in and done a lot for our people, and for me it's especially fulfilling to see that.
She's journeyed to areas where the war left its scars, looking deeper to document how people have survived the insurgency.
And what I've learned is that even in the midst of adversity, you know, people are able to continue and move on. People do not stop because of a bomb blast. I gravitate to children because of their exuberance. Even when you find them in a situation that is really bad, they're very bubbly and very lively, and that kind of keeps me going. I photograph a lot of street children and homeless children as well, and a lot of children that are escaping Boko Haram. And you see them mostly by the river or under the bridge, living on their own. But for these children, usually you kind of feel traumatized by their experience. You would wish for them to have a great future, but you know it will take a lot for them to have the kind of life that you would want for them. I just want people to know that, you know, Boko Haram is a small percentage of people that are wreaking havoc on a community, and the majority of people from Borno State are very peace-loving, very hospitable, very highly intelligent individuals. We're the same as every average Nigerian. We just want to live our lives.
If Nigeria is to heal from the war, the country must recover the bonds of humanity within its people. One picture at a time, Fati is bringing that humanity to light. Three years after Boko Haram kidnapped the Chibok girls, Buki Shonibare is still campaigning for their release. She posts photos on social media marking the days of their captivity, unwilling to let their plight fade from public memory. Even during her daily routines, the girls are never far from her thoughts.
Thank you. My major fear is by the time we have these girls come back, inevitably so, at least for the number that can come back, what life would they live for the rest of their lives? They've watched amputations happen in front of them. They've watched killings. They've watched draining of blood. They've watched airstrikes. They've watched people being buried in shallow graves. They've been abused. Some of them come back with children. How do you take those memories away from them?
While campaigning for the girls' release, Buki is battling the militants on a second front, a brazenly symbolic one.
The Boko Haram faction is talking.
She launched a charity project called School in a Bag. It delivers backpacks loaded with writing materials to children who don't have them and instructional kits to teachers.
The best way to win against those that have abducted your children is to use other children as a perfect example and a perfect testimony and representation of a better life that can happen because education is there. We are telling Boko Haram that you lost, and we are winning.
April 14, 2017, marked the third anniversary of the Chibok kidnappings. At that time, only 21 Chibok girls had been freed. Then on May 7th, 1,120 days after being taken, 82 more girls were released. Elation erupted at Unity Square in Abuja, where Bring Back Our Girls campaigners have kept their long protest vigil.
The fact that we can have 82 of our girls come back is a validation of everything we have been doing here every day. So 106 girls out of 219 that we've been waiting for 3 years, 3 weeks and 2 days today, they have come back. And that is a big deal.
News reports soon revealed that the release was part of a swap. In the exchange, the Nigerian government had freed several Boko Haram militants. But for Buki, no price is too high to pay for the girls' freedom.
For the girls, it means life to them. There was a life they had before they were abducted. They were going to school. To them, it means I am coming back to civilization. I am coming back to life. I can breathe. I can sleep with my two eyes closed.
What does the future hold for Nigeria?
The future of Nigeria is actually not as bleak as people make it to be. I think it's really very important to understand that Boko Haram is not Nigeria, and Nigeria is not Boko Haram.
After 8 years of conflict, some 20,000 dead, and millions of lives disrupted, how does the nation move forward?
So we've got to remake our society. We've got to have justice. We've got to have inclusion. People must feel part of the state. There must be many platforms and spaces for youth to self-actualize. There've got to be other paths that children can feel that they can contribute to society.
In a country so rich in diversity, tribal, cultural, language, religion, a core humanity survives.
One thing I've found with Nigeria is that sometimes the country pushes itself to an edge, and at that edge, it pulls itself back, and things move. You know, someone told me a joke and said, you know, it always seems as if the edge of uncertainty is Nigeria's comfort zone. When you think things are going to crumble, it always comes back together. And I think it's really the people in Nigeria. There is this can-do spirit in Nigeria. There's this spirit to thrive. There's this spirit to overcome the impossible in Nigeria.
a reminder that we appreciate all of the audience feedback. If you are a new fan, drop us a line at africatv@voanews.com. Just enter the keywords, Straight Talk Africa. Be sure to visit us online at voaafrica.com to join our YouTube channel. Sign up to VOA TV to Africa. Follow us on Twitter at VOA Shaka. Straight Talk Africa streams live every Wednesday on Facebook, or simply go to VOA's Straight Talk Africa TV program page on our website. To watch us live on your mobile device, download the VOA mobile app. Now let's look at what's on tap for next week's program. Next week on Straight Talk Africa, recent political developments in Kenya. President Uhuru Kenyatta has returned to office following a controversial repeat poll. And in Zimbabwe, after 37 years at the helm, Robert Mugabe is out of office and the new president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, is the new kid on the block and is talking the talk in Harare. But can he walk the talk so that Zimbabweans can walk the walk? That's coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. And on that note, thanks to for watching our documentary. Thanks to our affiliate stations, along with our viewers and listeners. For many of our Voice of America radio affiliates, learning English is coming up next. And tomorrow morning, it's Daybreak Africa with James Bate. On behalf of the Voice of America, thanks for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not beta Nigeria. And please remember to keep the African hopes alive.